Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, yesterday, a big Supreme Court decision in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case out of Denver, Colorado. A victory, but a small victory for religious liberty. A very narrow decision that focused on the conduct of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission in the case of Jack Phillips and Masterpiece Cake Shop in Denver. The Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, said that the state government, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, was, quote, neither tolerant nor respectful, unquote, towards Jack Phillips's Christian view on marriage. The court said the commission showed, quote, clear and impermissible hostility toward the sincere religious beliefs motivating his objection to making a cake for a same-sex wedding. So it was the Supreme Court pushing back against the Colorado Civil Rights Commission's anti-Christian bigotry. But it also limited itself to the ruling on the conduct of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. So they decided against setting a precedent in this case, which is why it's a small victory. It's an important victory for Jack Phillips, of course.
Well, yeah.
But in terms of religious freedom, it's a small victory, leaving precedential holding for potentially another case.
Right, because what if you're a photographer or a makeup artist or a hairstylist and you don't want to perform or do your works for a same-sex couple? Are they free and clear now to do what they want?
Well, what,
or is there possible litigation?
There's always the possibility of litigation, but what the Supreme Court did not do is recognize a First Amendment right to religious liberty for persons similarly situated to Jack Phillips, and that's, of course, what conservatives and constitutionalists, strict constructionists at least, wanted. They simply said the Colorado Civil Rights Commission went too far. You know, that conduct, not the inherent right embedded in the First Amendment. So that's a big difference. But this piece that was posted by Jack Phillips in USA Today, it's op-ed, after the Supreme Court's holding, tells you the story of not just his case, but where religious liberty stands. And so the importance of this discussion, just again to recall, Jack Phillips sets out that he is a cake artist who owns his own shop. I've always been willing to serve everyone who walks through my doors, but that doesn't mean that I create every cake requested of me. If I have to design a cake that celebrates an event or expresses a message in conflict with my faith, I'm obliged as a matter of conscience to decline. But I still offer those customers anything else in my shop and tell them I'd gladly create them a cake for a different occasion. And oh, by the way, just so we're clear, that's exactly what he did in this case. This was a setup from the beginning. He said that he would, to these two guys that came in that wanted to make a wedding cake, he said, look, I'll do anything else you want, but I can't do that. I'll make you birthday cake, shower cake, sell you cookies and brownies. I just don't make cakes for same-sex weddings. So this 30-second back and forth between the complainants initially to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and Jack Phillips was not confrontational. It was not him expressing any bigotry. It was him explaining his conscience on the issue, but otherwise being happy to serve them in another capacity.
Right.
So just so we're clear about that.
But they're still, you know, saying that this, their victims are discriminated against. Here is Mullins Craig.
We hope that people now know that our case wasn't some isolated incident, that this happens to people in every kind of business every day.
Is it really happening every day?
Well, here's the thing that he doesn't understand that disagreement is not discrimination. Disagreement
Very
is not
well
necessarily
put. That's so true.
Discrimination. And this is what the left can't wrap their head around, that if I want something, then I have the right to impose my will on you to provide it. So my desires don't stop at the tip of your nose when it comes to pushing you around in contravention of your religious belief to do my bidding. Here's just more from Jack Phillips, so you understand what he went through the past 6 years. It took 6 years to wind its way to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
He says, I was shocked at how many people dismiss my decision as making much ado about nothing. Just make the cake. Right?
Yeah.
Just make the cake. Yet folks fail to understand.
Shut up and bake, I think I heard somebody say.
Yeah, okay. Yet those folks fail to understand that as an artist, I pour my heart into my wedding cakes and that my conscience will not allow me to celebrate something in direct conflict with my faith. Right, of course. We don't have any respect, or some don't have any respect for what Jack Phillips says. You have to adopt my view of what you do. And you have to provide specific performance for what I say you do. This is a private transaction. People don't have to share my beliefs to support my freedom, writes Jack Phillips. They just need to agree that the decision should be mine to make, not the government's to make for me. What he's endured. After the government forced me to stop designing wedding cakes, I lost 40% of my business. Since then, I've been worried I've had to close my shop, that the revenue left won't be enough to make ends meet. I've been greatly distressed by the death threats hurled at me. Few things approach the horror of hearing another vow to take your life. And then there's this, just so you understand how significant the infringement is. The government ordered me not only to stop doing the wedding work I love, but also to teach my remaining employees, all of whom are my family members, that I was wrong to operate my shop consistent with my faith. In other words, the state told me to tell my mother that the faith she taught me has no business influencing my life. Think about it that way. The state in Colorado ordered me to teach my remaining employees who are family members I was wrong to operate my shop consistent with my faith. To tell my mother, in effect, that the faith she taught me has no business influencing my life. You want to talk about bigotry? You want to talk about freedom, equality under the law, respect, tolerance? All of those catchwords the left loves to throw around to cower the sissified individuals on the right who know better but won't stand up in face of this kind of onslaught. Think about that. Ordering you to tell your family members that your faith is wrong and that the faith that you, faith tradition you inherited from your ancestors is wrong at the hands of the state. You want to talk about the imposition of a state religion? It's the imposition of the expungement of religion at the hands of the state. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know what? I would have made the cake, but anyway, my point is that this was
You're free to make the cake. That's the point. You're free to make the cake, and he's free not to. That's the point.
That is the point. But what is huge about this particular case, it's going to wake up a lot of people that are sitting on the fence and almost buying the crap that's put out by the liberal media. We need a president in there that's going to put on responsible, educated, logical people on that Supreme Court, not the ideologues that you always say that a Democrat has always put on that Supreme Court. That's why this case was huge.
Yeah,
so
thanks.
Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call. Well, right, and it's a 7-2 decision. It wasn't a close call.
I know. Weren't you surprised?
No.
When you saw the rundown of who voted for who? I thought it was going to be 5-4.
Yeah,
decision.
I mean, not because of how narrow the decision was. I'm not surprised. But, I mean, in terms of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission overreaching, Jack Phillips puts it in layman's terms very nicely in his op-ed. But it was this was not a close case, but it shows you how close we are to real elimination of people's religious freedom. And this case again was great for Jack Phillips, but it's still an open question what it means for religious liberty in America.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
I can't stop watching this shot. Yesterday we had our semifinals for our boys and 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th boys volleyball teams. And Andrew, he had a header shot. I'm going to put it on Twitter. You've got to see
a
it.
A header?
Well, he didn't know.
It's volleyball, not soccer.
I know, but he was just standing there, and he lost track of where the ball was, and it hit his head, went over the net, and they scored a point. It's awesome.
That may make SportsCenter.
I know. I have to enlarge. I need the guys here, the young kids here to help me.
Sure.
Lighten it up and
fast
edit.
Out with the interweb and all that.
But yesterday the referee did something. I just wanted to mention this real quick. Something I've never seen before in all the years of coaching, which has been 4 years, but 12 different
all
teams.
All 4 years? You've never seen this?
This ref, the other team had 4 coaches, which was ridiculous. And one was on the other side of the gym. He's like, no, get in here. You can't coach from the other side. You know, everybody's on the bench.
It was a pincer movement,
honestly, there was one, in the back court, left, back, right. And he's, bring it in. But the coach on the other team said, yo, I need a timeout. And the ref put the ball down. And he's like, you never address me ever. Yo, it is sir or mister or ref. And the kids were shocked. And I just thought, okay, it's true. Because if we start, it's the coarsening of our language when people approach adults and say, yo, I need a timeout. What is that?
What about zebra? Will he accept zebra?
Volleyball officials are very, very, very strict.
Oh, yeah. You roll the ball under the net. There's etiquette.
It's insane how strict they are, yeah. How you approach the net,
how you even see it
in the Olympics and in the professional leagues. They're very, very, you're very cautious around officials.
And if you mess up, they'll give you a side out. They don't care.
They'll take away points. They're serious about
their trigger in volleyball. Huh?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
I've never seen anything like it. It was intense. Yeah. But both 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th are advancing to the finals today. It's at the Halstead Center at 3656 Halstead.
You better get there early.
Sell those tickets.
No, at 3:45 is the 5th and 6th, and then at 4:15 is the 7th and 8th.
Hold on, let me get the 3:45.
Can you put that in your calendar?
And then
7th and 8th is at 4:15. My team plays Disney, and the 7th and 8th graders play Lincoln. That's going to be a really
3:45 and 4:15. The games are like 20 minutes?
No, it'll probably, sometimes they last, sometimes a game could last 7 minutes. Sometimes you'll have a game where a player will never touch the ball.
It's
boom, 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 boom. Yep. Okay.
All right. There's your Chicago grade school volleyball update.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5, on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you don't stand for the anthem. You're not coming to the White House, even if you win a Super Bowl. That's the message that was delivered by President Trump to the Philadelphia Eagles organization. And, of course, getting what you would expect the response to be from the left. But
he tweeted yesterday, about 8 hours ago, the Philadelphia Eagles football team was invited to the White House. Unfortunately, only a small number of players decided to come, and we canceled the event. Staying in the locker room for the playing of our national anthem is as disrespectful to our country as kneeling. Sorry! !
Yeah, the statement from the press secretary's office, from the president, they're unable to come with their full team to be celebrated tomorrow, meaning today. They disagree with their president because he insists that they proudly stand for the national anthem, hand on heart, in honor of the great men and women of our military and the people of our country.
But here's the sticky wicket on this. Not once during the entire season did any Philadelphia Eagles player take a knee. One player raised his... No, he didn't. I'm telling you. One player did raise a fist like this up high. And that's it. That's why people were confused. But CNN was reporting that only 10 to 15 players were confirmed. And adding fuel to the fire is the mayor of Philadelphia, Jim Kenney, who was on CNN, did a little phoner.
There's no one more disrespectful to this country than the president of the United States, which is a sad thing to say, but it's true. The guy talks about being... He avoided the draft 5 times. in Vietnam. If he wanted to be patriotic, he could have been patriotic back then, as opposed to this sham of a of an issue relative to the national anthem.
312-642-5600 is our Trinky.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, a point of order, this sham of an issue with the national anthem, didn't the NFL just change the rule on it?
Yeah.
So the NFL owners all agree to a rule change. So is it a sham? Is this just all President Trump's doing? Or did the NFL change the rule with respect to respecting the anthem in response to market feedback from their fans? Mayor? Mayor?
Hello? Where'd you go, Mayor?
But, I mean, there is a crowd size element to the story, considering there's only 10 to 15 players. But if those 10 to 15 players wanted to go, I mean, if I was one of those players who wanted to go, I'd be disappointed this morning.
Well, I hate to break it to the Eagles, but you have no right to go to the White House to be feted because you won the Super Bowl. That is not in the Constitution.
No, that's true. I mean, is President Trump in the right or the wrong here? 312-642-5600.
The whole kind of photo op of bringing the championship teams from all the sports to the White House.
All of them. From NCAA. I mean, every sport you can think of.
What started out as a nice thing, like everything is ruined by politics. And, I don't care. Everybody, then now in this day and age, and this, by the way, happened during President Obama's term, too. There were players on championship teams that didn't want to go to the White House.
And Jake Arrieta didn't go.
There you go.
When
that's
President
a good
Obama,
example.
You know, crammed that through so that Michelle could see her heroes.
Yeah, is Jake Arrieta, is he a traitor to our nation because he didn't go, you know, guffaw with President Obama after the Cubs won in 15? I just we have to do the spectacle of Steph Curry is not coming and Kevin Durant's not coming and Torrey Smith doesn't want to go from the Eagles, but other players do, and then this is this whole controversy, and you have to reach critical mass to come. And just don't invite them. Just end the tradition.
End it, yeah.
Your championship team, and that's great. I mean, is there enough adulation for, as much of a sports fan as I am, is there enough adulation for high-profile sports figures and teams in this country? I mean, goodness. That the entitled...
It is such a distraction. I mean, President Trump has some very pressing issues on his plate right now. He is the G7 summit in Quebec, and then he has Kim Jong-un, one-night-only date. That they have.
It's just the entitlement mentality, and, like, you know, they're slight. They slight the president, and so he, you know, says, okay, well, you're uninvited. And then they say, how dare you uninvite me? Well, you don't want it. You don't like me anyway. I don't even understand it, honestly.
It's like a bad relationship.
Yeah. I'm not coming to your party.
You're not invited.
How do you, you just uninvited me from your party? That's not right. I have some friends that wanted to come to your party.
My wife wanted to go.
You're just canceling the whole thing? I mean, what? It's so childish. Tim in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Amy. I don't get this. When I got four kids, when three of them didn't want to go on vacation somewhere, we said, okay, we won't go there. We'll go somewhere else. No big deal. So most of the team doesn't want to go to the White House. Okay, so we're not going to go there. Now all of a sudden it's a big deal. It sounds real childish. That's all I got to say.
Thanks for the call, Tim. You should have let that one kid who didn't want to go on vacation go on his own vacation.
I just take my kids. I don't ask them. I tell them where we're going.
Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, Dan. Trump's exactly right because those owners are dumb enough and weak enough to allow those players to make their statements on the field like that or in their locker room or whatever it is, but just do all that. Trump doesn't have to allow them to make any kind of statement on the White House grounds or anything like that. That's exactly the right thing to do. And then this other fellow brings up about Trump's background with the draft or something like that. Listen, I believe that Trump is a totally different person than he was many, many years ago.
Yep.
That guy has changed.
All right. All right. Thanks for the call, Craig. I mean, Chris
Carter. To bring that up again. And look how unpatriotic he is.
Hall of Famer Chris Carter tweeted, President Obama should invite the Eagles to his house for a barbecue. Fine. Go, do it. Yeah, go to Obama's house for barbecue if he'll invite you. Okay, fine. Yeah, maybe he'll invite Chris and the NFL Countdown guys, too. Who cares? He's like, oh, boy, you zinger. You got somebody over son. You know, Valerie Jarrett can, you know, I don't know. She can cater it. Whatever. Go ahead. You're killing me. Philip in Blue Island.
It's funny you said who cares, but obviously the president cares. But what he doesn't care about is the real issue of police brutality against black and brown people.
Yeah,
so to make it about the flag, and especially for a draft dodger like the president of the United States, it's crazy. You mentioned Obama. You mentioned Valerie Jarrett. Why are you mentioning these people of color instead of mentioning Bush or other white president?
Because Philip, you're not listening, and I was just recalling a tweet from Chris Carter.
I was listening, but I'm just saying for you to go further to mention Valerie Jarrett. Well, kind of, especially in the
oh my, I know. You know what, Philip? You're so tiresome. Everything is racist to you. It's just tiresome. Grow up. You're as childish as sometimes the president acts and all these professional athletes. I'm so tired of it. I'm just not going to tolerate that. Every joke, every lampooning of a politician or his political hack aides, if they're black, it's racist. It's the last refuge of the scoundrel, Philip, and you're an intellectual scoundrel. Dennis in Villa Park.
Yeah, I guess that means that I can't make a cake then for the Philadelphia Eagles, huh?
I don't know. You know, I'm going to have to reread the holding in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. Thanks for the call, Dennis.
Too soon.
Yeah, could you make it?
Well, you can, yeah. Make a cake.
Paul in Naperville.
Hey, so I think Trump did this to avoid the inevitable news media stories that would have came out today if they were actually invited, saying, hey, you know what, look at how unpopular Trump is. Not even the Philadelphia Phillies Eagles will go to the White House. Look at this. He's the most unpopular president ever. And I think he just decided to change the narrative before that happened.
I think he's got other things on his plate, but okay.
No, I don't. I think well, he does. Thanks for the call, Paul. But I think Paul's right. I think there is that he didn't want a spectacle at his expense.
Well,
at the White House, which is fine.
Thousands of fans are going to be there to greet what 10 to 15 players. Said it's not worth it.
Well, right, okay. But to his point on ESPN and everywhere else, it's going to be this. You know, the story is going to be who didn't show up or how many didn't show up and the divisiveness and the anthem and the policy. I mean, the other thing that Trump understands, by the way, it's not just to save face. It's also to prosecute an issue on which he's winning. Think about it both ways.
Right. And although no Philadelphia Eagles players took a knee, the league as a whole and the union members are not happy with his edict and how the NFL has changed their policy now that you cannot stand. I mean, that if you cannot kneel during a game, else you'll be you can be suspended, and your team will be fined, right?
Right. Unless,
so if you don't want to stand up, stay in the locker room.
But wait, what owner said, is it the Jets owner who said he would pay the fines for those who wanted, or the Giants?
No.
One of the owners said he would pay the fines for his players who wanted to protest to make a spectacle of themselves. So, you know, okay, fine.
Yeah, it is the Jets. I love this Google thing. It's really nice.
It's helpful.
Yeah.
Mike in Bolingbrook.
Hey,
yeah.
Yeah, Dan. First of all, a couple issues. Number one, has anybody researched the fact that Trump actually dodged the draft? Or did he have a legitimate reason?
Well, you know,
one of those bone spurs
deferments that's
okay,
questionable.
Second point. I'm one of those guys that hasn't watched the NFL in 2 years.
Wow.
In 2 years, okay? And I don't miss it at all. And the third point I want to make, and it's a strong point, none of these people that are going to the White House to visit probably ever served. And if they did, they're proud and stand like that guy. I believe it was from the Eagles that went out, or from the
Steelers
that went out.
Yeah.
A war veteran.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah,
and what's his name again? We should mention his name again.
Villarreal. Yeah.
That was such – I was at that game, and I'll never forget. That was – I got the chills.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing, too. I mean, you've obviously had players that have served, NFL players who have served.
Look at Tillman, he served.
Pat Tillman, right? Tillman. And yeah, it is interesting how they approach it with, from the experience of being in the military and maybe even just respecting your colleagues in your profession who have served, even if you've got complaints with the country. I mean, you can air your grievances in this country. You don't have to make a spectacle of yourself. And if you want to make a spectacle of yourself, you can. But guess what? In your employment confines, your employer has something to say about it. Welcome to freedom. It goes a lot of different directions.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the Eagles being uninvited from the White House. I suppose with respect to the soon-to-be-crowned Golden State Warriors NBA champion, President Trump maybe should just issue a peremptory disinvitation.
That if you win, you're not coming to the White House.
Because Steph Curry is not going to want to come. And,
no, he won't be.
And Kevin Durant's not going to want to come.
Steve Kerr, their coach, isn't going to want to come.
Kevin Durant may be, probably be afraid that Laura Ingram could be there. And, you know, she'll tell him to shut up and dribble again. For more on this topic and also NBA fashion, we're pleased to be joined by a senior writer for NBA.com, our friend Steve Ashburner. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. Do we have Steve?
Steve.
Hello.
There we go. Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Yeah. Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. So here's the thing. If the Cavs lose, once upon a time, they were burning LeBron James' jerseys in effigy. Do you think that Cavs fans will burn his suit shorts suit in effigy?
For losing the finals? No, they'll wait until July until he changes teams again.
Yeah, right, exactly. The prospects for a Cavs comeback, a little basketball, the prospect that Game 3 is tomorrow, they got hammered in Game 2 in Golden State. They are up against overwhelming firepower. Is this going to be like a 4-1?
Yeah, I wrote about this and previewed the final series, I mean, that was my prediction, that the Cavs would win one of these games in Cleveland here Wednesday or Friday and send everybody back to Golden State, to Oakland for the championship clincher. It just seems like you look at the teams and it's pretty obvious in relative strength that you know, LeBron is the best player on the floor, and then if you were picking playground style, you might then be down to, you know, fifth or sixth when you take Kevin Love, who's his teammate in Cleveland, and then you might be down to 10th or beyond when you pick another Cavalier. So the imbalance in talent in these rosters is pretty dramatic. And as great as he can be, and I don't begrudge him that at all, I mean, this postseason, to me, is the first time that he has sort of lifted himself and clamored up into the discussion among the, you know, the greatest of all time players.
Don't even say better than Michael Jordan. Don't say it.
I won't. But that's, you know, it's just not enough. And the way that Golden State can attack in multiple ways, I think LeBron's going to run out of gas.
Oh, do you? Yeah, because without him, I mean, he's their whole offense. What, he scored 51 points the first game?
51, correct. And really, their whole offense is predicated on him being such a threat and being able to break down the opposing team defense that they start to cheat and collapse on him or double-team him, as they did in Game 2. So he finds, with the ball, he finds teammates on the perimeter who, you know, hoist those three-point shots. And those guys have to hit those shots, otherwise it all kind of falls apart. And you know, they just have not gotten reliable shooting from the likes of Kyle Korver or J.R. Smith or George Hill, you know, some of the guys that they employ almost specifically for their ability to hit the long ball.
Kyle Korver, he was on the Bulls for a time when we still had a franchise in Chicago until they folded.
No, they're starting over. And really, they're starting over.
Yeah, Fred Hoiberg is going to be the starting two guard, I think, next year. Okay. So here's a question for you, though, Steve. Should we apply the D word to Golden State? Are we looking at Golden State having John Wooden run here, and as long as Steph Curry and Kevin Durant are around?
Well, if they win a third championship in 4 years, if the only year they didn't win, they set the all-time regular season record for victories, 73. I think that you have to look at them with some of the teams that we consider to be, you know, somewhat dynastic, including the, you know, the Bulls with six championships in 8 years, you know, various Showtime Laker teams, the San Antonio team that, you know, had the long run with Tim Duncan. It's almost like they were like a jack-o'-lantern of championships. They would win, then they would take a year off, then they would win, and, you know, you have these spaces in there. But, and then, of course, the Russell Celtics are sort of beyond grasp, just because they were so dominant and there really was not serious competition for much of their run.
With the Eagles controversy in the last 24 hours, why is it that the NBA hasn't become as politicized as the NFL, hasn't suffered the same way the NFL has? I mean, you've had dust-ups. I mentioned, you know, Kevin Durant and LeBron James being told by Laurie Ingram to just shut up and dribble. You've had Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr be kind of openly critical of President Trump. But it just you haven't had any of the anthem antics. It just doesn't seem you haven't had the same level of politicization in the NBA and the NFL, and I wonder if you have a perspective on why.
I think there are a few reasons. One is that the NBA sort of preempted this whole thing by having a rule on the books, and this predates even David Stern regarding the national anthem. So, you know, they can say, well, they might not like the rule and they may want the rule changed, but I don't think anybody really paid attention to it or got around to it. I mean, so that's there to, head off a lot of this stuff. I think also it's an environment in which I think a lot of people believe players, some of those more emotional coaches, believe that everybody does think the way they do. And so I don't think they feel like they have to, you know, convince people or make a demonstration quite the same way. And you know, I think they're a little delusional in that, but I do think that it's like, well, of course we all think this way, and it never really gets probed. And then the you know, another reason, and I was talking with Adam Silver for a few minutes over the weekend out in Oakland, and, you know, he was talking about how just, you know, respect of everybody's views are important, and that's a word he goes to a lot. I also think that these guys do have fairly large platforms in other areas, whether it's, you know, shoe endorsements, commercial deals. You know, they have a visibility, even just the fact that they play out there in, you know, essentially, you know, old-fashioned underwear. they're visible. You see their faces. You're relatively close. The cameras are on. I don't think they feel as anonymous and therefore driven to, I need to make a statement and have people notice who I am when my helmet's off, because when my helmet's on, I don't really, you know, have much personality out there. And I think these guys are a little bit more known quantities overall.
Yeah, it's a friendlier setting, because when you see their eyes and their facial expressions, it's different.
Kevin Durant, you know, he was in a recent episode of Billions. He's trying to get his acting career going, too.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, looks like it.
Well, back to the Philadelphia Eagles. Not one player during the course of the season took a knee, so why is it that only 10 to 15 players wanted to go today to the White House?
Yeah, I you know, that's just sort of become this thing now. And, you know, to be perfectly fair, we should note that at some point during when the Miami Heat won a couple championships, Pat Riley, the team president, did not go to the White House while Barack Obama was president. I think Tom Brady missed a White House visit when Obama was president with the Patriots. And again, they were not like team-inspired boycotts. I think it just fits in with where we are, that passing up an opportunity to go there and maybe get a comment or two in edgewise, you know, to the president as he shakes your hand. I mean, to actually engage in, you know, a few syllables of dialogue doesn't interest people as much as taking a visible stand and not dialoguing. You know, everybody wants that conversation until it's time to have a conversation.
What about just the whole sort of pro forma invitation to the championship team, to the White House, and should that, for in everybody's mental health interest, just go by the boards?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that right, you back this whole thing up, you know, a little ways, and that you've got that ceremonial stuff, and, you know, who's getting more out of it? Is it, you know, the president, his administration, and this photo op for, you know, sports fans that, you know, maybe they don't know if they're quite under the, you know, the umbrella? Or is it, you know, the sports teams themselves and, you know, what a thrill to go to the White House and meet the president of the United States, whoever it happens to be. That used to be, I think, the side on which most of this fell, but, you know, it's flipped. And maybe the fact that, you know, in a crazed media world, it's not as big a deal to go to the White House or meet the president. You feel like that stuff's already in your living room all the time. And so now you have to have, you know, hard political opinions about things rather than just be, you know, respectful of the concept and the whole, you know.
Well, who started that?
And just be I'm a baseball player, yeah.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but how did that whole thing with bringing sports teams to the White House begin?
That I don't know. You know, I'm not sure if Washington or Jefferson brought
it. Yeah, yeah.
early
styles, yeah. You know, the whole thing, presidents throwing out the baseball on opening day, you know, I think that goes back to about Taft or whatever. But
right.
Beyond that, in terms of these visits, I'm not sure that I heard much about it before Nixon. You know, Nixon was a huge NFL fan, and I think Washington might have won, not sure. You know, when he was in there, he was known for giving, you know, coaching tips, as they would put it, to George Allen, who coached there for a spell. And so maybe that was a little bit of it. I know, you know, before that, mostly I recall is presidents being photographed, you know, from Kennedy, Eisenhower, a few before that, throwing out the first ball. But for teams actually going to the White House, I don't know. I think that's a little bit more modern. It could be. I mean, who knows? It might have been the Miracle on Ice team, you know, in 80 that started that. I'm not sure.
Sure, the Kennedy throwing out the first ball to Joe DiMaggio, who then threw it to Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
They kind of had to do
it. And President Trump hasn't thrown out a first pitch yet, correct?
I don't believe he has.
Yeah.
Just going back to the major sports again, NBA versus NFL versus, say, baseball, what about the coverage of it? What about the media side of it? It seems to me, and I don't watch ESPN like I used to, but it seems to me that the pundits that cover football for ESPN and, you know, other sports networks, it seems to me maybe they're a little bit more politicized too than some of the reporters and pundits for that are more focused on the other sports. Or maybe it's just that the NFL is so much more central to their programming than some of the other sports. I'm not sure which it is. Do you have any perspective on that?
I guess, can you give me a for instance regarding, you know, what level?
Well, I mean, I just think, like, you know, you hear, like, Chris Carter tweeted yesterday about the Eagles thing. President Obama should invite the Eagles to his house for a barbecue. Stephen A. Smith has waded into politics. Now he covers, you know, the NBA as much as he does, more than he does at the NFL. But it just seems to me on some of the countdown shows. And maybe, again, it's maybe just because I'm more inclined to watch that than some of the other stuff on ESPN, that there's more politics infused from. I mean, I remember, for example, Kansas City Chiefs when that, what was his name, Belcher, the linebacker who tried to kill his, or did, what was it, he killed his girlfriend and then he killed himself.
Right outside the
and Adam Schefter went on this rant about gun control, and Bob Costas when he was doing sports. Yeah. It just seems to me they're more inclined to wade into the public policy of the political arena than some of the reporters or pundits, analysts in the other sports.
Well, I mean, the TNT studio show of, you know, with Shaq and Kenny Smith and Charles Barkley and Ernie Johnson, I mean, they will take on these things as well. And what you often see is, you know, two of the four or three of the four, you know, might have the same opinion on something. And then, you know, there's usually at least one person that's a counterbalance. I'm not sure if you get the counterbalance on, you know, some of the NFL stuff. I don't watch enough of that to really know. I'm more aware, you know, I am aware of Costas and striding positions that he has put out there during sports telecasts. I think part of it goes to, and I've been in this sports side of journalism, you know, my entire career, so I can attest to this, I guess, is a lot of people on this side of it. There's a little bit of a sheepishness or inferiority complex that, you know, I'm a journalist, but I don't really cover anything that matters. And therefore, I need to sort of puff up when I get an opportunity to wade into a social topic. And almost more so, I mean, we talk about bias in mainstream media. And it's almost less checked, you know, than in, you know, the political side or the news side, because you are covering things that don't matter. It long has been known as the toy department of news. And so you're, you know, it's like, well, I have to feel good about myself and be able to look my peers in the eye when I walk through the Washington Post newsroom to get to the sports department. And I think there's that. I think there's, you know, people start out and I want to be Woodward and Bernstein. And, you know, eventually you want to be Bob Costas. So you want to be, I don't even know who the sort of national writers are at this stage. It's all gotten so splintered. But, you know, Dick Young or Red Smith, or, you know, to really reach back. But, you know, there's that, I think. There's sort of this sense that I don't really matter. I need to. So to me, that's the problem with these coaches that go on these rants, is that they're doing it to a nodding audience of young alleged journalists who don't ever push back. And to me, that's the biggest problem with mainstream media, is when they agree with the people they cover, they don't push back. They don't scrutinize. Only when they disagree, and they shouldn't even be in the business of disagreeing. They should only be, you know, in the matter of, you know, in the business of covering and carrying, you know, alternative views. But when they disagree, as we see a lot with, you know, in this Trump era, all they want to do is push back and ignore, you know, anything legit that comes from that side of things.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting perspective. I think that makes a lot of sense. He is Steve Ashburner. He is a senior writer for NBA.com. Get his, you can also follow him on Twitter, ASCHNBA. Get his reviews of the NBA Finals for as long as they continue. Steve, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure. Good talking with you.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, so the coward of Broward is speaking, Amy.
Ooh, yeah, he's tired of being called a coward. He's been forced into a life of seclusion. You know, he retired 8 days after that, has been collecting a hefty pension.
$8,000 a month.
Is hoping to get out of the spotlight because he feels awful about what happened.
I'm sorry that I didn't.
So what they did yesterday, Savannah Guthrie has gotten the exclusive interview with him. He's coming forward in hopes of trying to clear his name. So they haven't released the entire interview. That's going to be broadcast at, I think, 8 o'clock Eastern time, so 7 o'clock our time. But he tried to shed light on what happened.
So your dispatcher, nobody's giving you any information.
No intel. No real-time intelligence whatsoever.
About a shooter inside the building.
Inside the building or even at the school, exactly.
You buying any of this?
Well, did you hear the shots being fired? Did you run to the sound of the gunfire?
He said that he heard, but he wasn't sure where the shots were coming from. So he took a position outside the school, hoping that the shooter, if he was running out or running into that building, that he could hit him there.
So your dispatcher.
Excuse me.
This will haunt me the rest of my life. It will. Those are my kids. You know, those were my kids.
And a lot of the victim's family members are taking offense to him saying, those were my kids.
Well, there was,
like, if they were your kids, you would have run in and done something more.
You know, this whole Broward County Sheriff's Office is not holding up well under scrutiny. The Scott Israel is also sort of a mess. Mm-hmm. And there was a case reported down in Miami a couple of weeks ago about these two again. Scott Peterson was assigned to a case involving an alleged assault of one student by other students at Stoneman. And it was one of the accused who was given a 3-day suspension was Scott Israel's kid.
I know, yeah.
And now they're suggesting cover-up. Here's the case. The case involved two 17-year-old students bullying a 14-year-old freshman, one holding down the younger boy by his ankles while the other kicked the victim, grabbed his genitals, and then took the victim's own baseball bat and began shoving it against his backside, simulating rape through the boy's clothes. And again, one of the assailants was Scott Israel, the sheriff's son. Rather than this being referred as potentially a criminal matter, they left it, let it be an administrative matter and three-day suspensions. And this goes back to a couple of things. One is potentially, you know, Scott Peterson covering for his boss. Number two is this whole regime at that school, and it's not limited to that school. This is, another idea exported from the brilliance that goes on in CPS here, because that's where their superintendent is from, Chicago. That we don't discipline, we don't refer to, we don't make criminal referrals.
No, it's in-house, all in-house.
And even in-house, we're loath to discipline.
So they asked, you know, Savannah asked him, are you a coward?
Were you a coward?
Never.
That's what they called you, the coward of Broward County.
I know, never. I never had a chance. I never thought even for a moment of being scared or a coward, because I was just doing things the whole time. It never entered my mind.
I don't think he did himself any favors by coming forward and telling his story.
Well, we'll have more on that interview when the entirety of it is aired, and we'll pick up the conversation there.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. Bill, Hillary Clinton, stay on TV. I want you on TV every single day. I'll explain when Freedom returns at 5.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So President Trump, last week's jobs report, tweeted out best economy, best jobs report or job climate ever.
It tweeted broke protocol because the job numbers were out yet.
Oh, yeah. He jumped the gun, too.
But
it's the best
ever. I
wasn't
offended by that. I mean, whatever.
Yeah. He got the. I guess there's conspiracy theories about what he's somehow trading on insider information. Ooh. Because he got the
job
BLS report
first?
Before. Oh, yeah, the BLS BS report.
He's
before.
President. I don't know.
Here's the thing: the best economy ever is what he's saying. Mm-hmm. If you can get beyond the report and the surrounding conspiracy theories. Jim Pethakukas, our friend, American Enterprise Institute, is risking being uninvited from the White House by disagreeing. Jim joins us now. Jim, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the uninvitation's already happened, but I'll do my best.
Call you the Eagles.
You have a standing uninvitation, is what you're saying.
I believe it's standing and permanent.
Why is Trump wrong to say best economy ever? By what measure is he wrong?
Kind of by just about any measure. Look, if we went back to 2000 and you looked at a chart of job growth, if you looked at a chart of economic growth, you would not say, oh, there's where Trump became president. It's been pretty steady, since the Obama administration, since the economy really covered as the Great Recession. Listen, the economy is growing about what it did, 2%-ish. That's not great. That's slower than it has since World War II, the average. Unemployment is low. It's been lower. It could go lower. That would be fantastic. This has been a very, very long expansion. But if you compare this economy to, the 90s, where you had 4% and 5% growth, very low unemployment, and most importantly, the single most important economic statistic is productivity. How productive workers are. That boom, that is really why we had a 1990s boom. That is dead in the water currently, and we will not be able to sustain this growth, and we will not have sharply higher wages unless that improves. And right now, that's going nowhere.
But the worker productivity is a good point, and I think probably an underappreciated one.
It's the most important point.
No,
you cannot
call
this economy the best ever. It is the number one economic statistic that drives living standards that make sure our kids have a better life than us. That needs to improve.
No, I can see that point. I can see that point, and it's and I, as I was saying, it's an underappreciated point when we talk about the all the data that measures how good we're doing. Is not a lot of people focus on worker productivity, and that's an appropriate focus. However, I would just say in terms of Trump's policies, forget this, you know, the puffery of best economy ever and so forth. But I mean, reducing the corporate and personal income tax rates, the another underappreciated thing that's occurred in his time is the deregulation. You have a slight but nevertheless real reduction in federal headcount, so sort of size and scope and expense of government. I mean, those are positives, are they not?
Listen, it's tough to talk about the size and scope of government if you got some guy at the Commerce Department going through a spreadsheet saying, we're going to put a tariff on this one, we're not going to put a tariff on that one. That is size and scope of government. Listen, I like tax cuts. I'm glad we got that corporate rate down. That is a very good long-term policy goal. We should not. What it's supposed to do is boost worker productivity. That's over the long term. Anything that happens really now and over the next year or so is good old-fashioned Keynesian stimulus, juicing the economy sugar high. That's what Republicans criticized Obama for. That's what we're doing right now with a deficit-financed tax cut. So listen, all these Wall Street banks, they think the economy should jump this year and next year. You know, hey, that's great, but that's not because of, you know, Republican economics. That's the kind of stuff that we criticized Obama for. It may eventually boost productivity, but that should be down the line. Anything you see right now, it's exactly the kind of thing Republicans hated, sugar economics.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I am going to pull rank on you, though.
Uh-oh.
All right?
Here we go.
You ready? Larry Kudlow. I'm pulling rank. Larry Kudlow suggesting, number one, Justin Trudeau shouldn't be running around with his hair on fire for a little tariff. Number two, that the tariffs, though he is not a tariff, which is a tax guy, of course, he's a free trader. But it's still, according to Larry, it's still a lever for a medium-term growth play to reduce barriers across the board, whether it's NAFTA or our Chinese trading partners. Is Larry right to be so optimistic?
No, listen, you know, that's a fantasy that all of a sudden that all these tariffs, it's all going to lead to this kind of like free trade nirvana. Far more likely, it's going to lead to the breakdown of the global trading system. That's what other people in that administration, like Peter Navarro, want. They don't like globalization. They don't like these global supply chains. They want to bring us back to about the 1950s. That is not the direction we're heading. And, you know, Larry can say what he wants, but listen, I think that's a fantasy, and there's no evidence that's working, and there's been no evidence that Trump's been able to strike like better deals. We just did this agreement with South Korea. We got nothing out of it other than like the distrust of a key ally.
So would you say that the troika of Ross, Lighthizer, and Navarro sort of the biggest threat to growth? Growth-oriented policies coming from the Trump administration? I mean, in addition to the president himself subscribing to it.
Listen, I'm not going to call them an axis of evil because they're not evil, but it's kind of an axis of dopiness. It's completely the wrong direction. It's tough to find an economist who agrees with it. It's right now it's tough to find a businessman agree with it. Even the steelworkers union doesn't like these tariffs. This is really keyed off the idiosyncratic outlying views of Wilbur Ross, Navarro, and the president, whose views on this haven't changed for 40 years, which means they've been wrong for 40 years.
Well, what do you think is going to happen at the G7 summit in Quebec? I mean, do you think they're going to get through to get through to President Trump?
No, listen. I know that people like Larry Kudlow and Steve Moore, who you probably had on the show, they've explained all this with trade to Kudlow to the president repeatedly. It has not sunk in. Our problem is not trade deficits. To the extent we have a trade problem, it's that we have China, which is on this kind of like tech war against America, you know, stealing our intellectual property and stealing technology. and these sort of state-run businesses supported by their government. That's the problem. It's not cars or sorghum or any of this stuff, and that's not what we're focused on. And again, utterly the wrong direction. Thank goodness that we still have this expansion, which has been in place since 2009, won't last forever, and nothing we're doing right now, with perhaps the exception of the big corporate tax rate cut, is helping that.
Yeah, but the problem, too, just as that sort of exacerbates this dynamic you're describing, is you talk about the G7 summit. He's not going there. It's not a Milton Friedman society. He's going there to talk to a bunch of socialists about trade policy. I mean, this is the tit-for-tat crowd.
Well, listen, if you're looking for the sort of the big government kind of like left-wing trade policy, listen, if you look at Trump's trade policy and what our trade policy would be like if Bernie Sanders was president, you could not find a difference. We have the Bernie Sanders trade policy that somehow we managed to get to the left of all these European countries. It's really amazing.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the pick-me-up, Jim.
Go lower corporate tax rate, Dan and Amy. Go lower corporate tax rate.
All right.
And real quick question. I mean, I love these tax cuts, but I feel like I'm pouring that extra savings into my gas tank. Any relief anytime soon?
Do they have the scooters yet in Chicago, like they do in San Francisco? We try the scooter.
Yeah,
or the Divvy bike. Okay.
The solar-powered scooter. Yeah.
That's right. Right. That's right. Power. Perfect combo.
Jim Pethakuka, CNBC contributor and columnist for the American Enterprise Institute. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Jimmy P. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so Bill Clinton's continuing his book tour with James Patterson, this novel, The President's Missing. He's out there hawking, and he clarified yesterday in New York that bitchy interview he gave on the Today Show.
Oh, he was a little ornery. Didn't see it coming, did he?
The demand about whether he or not he personally apologized to Monica Lewinsky. Here's a kinder, gentler Bill Clinton.
The truth is, the hubbub was I got hot under the collar.
Yeah.
Because of the way the questions were asked, and I think what was lost are the two points that I made that are important to me. The suggestion was that I'd never apologized for what caused all the trouble for me 20 years ago. So first point is, I did. I meant it then and I meant it now. I apologize to my family, to Monica Lewinsky and her family, and to the American people. Before a panel of ministers in the White House.
Well, before a panel of ministers before a panel of selected ministers in the White House. Not exactly what we're talking about. Oh, by the way, and actually Megyn Kelly, to her credit, pointed this out. In the Me Too era, since you're such a big Me Too supporter, Mr. President, you also have to respond to those persistent rape allegations.
Oh, yeah.
Did you apologize?
Craig Melvin didn't bring that up.
Did you apologize to Paula Jones? You settled a lawsuit with her.
No. Well, first of all, Monica Lewinsky's never asked for an apology. But also, too, Craig Melvin, that reporter at NBC, he was just trying to make a name for himself, trying to elevate his status there on NBC.
I'm sorry. What's his name?
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's primary day in California today, and it's really interesting. There's a couple of sort of important storylines. Well,
yeah,
one really
Orange County. What a bizarre voting procedure that is.
Well, they have a jungle primary system, so the top two finishers are in a runoff, so it could be two Democrats, it could be two Republicans. The same thing at the statewide level. So there, on the one hand, there's the substantive issue of the Democrats' path to a congressional majority running through California, where there are seven Republican-held seats where the residents there in each of those seven voted for Hillary Clinton over Trump in 16. So they see a lot of upside potential for gain, 7 GOP-held seats that went for Hillary Clinton. So that's the substantive part of it. The bizarre part of it is John Cox could be in a runoff with the former Mr. Guilfoyle for California governor.
I know. I know him. I know his wife. It's very bizarre.
John Cox was...
ran for Senate here, and he paid people to stand behind him and hold signs while one time I was doing a live shot at Channel 5.
Well, to be fair, I mean, President Trump literally did the same at his announcement.
I mean, it's not illegal or anything. It just feels wrong.
So John Cox, for those who don't remember, was sort of a perennial candidate for the first part of this century in Illinois, perennial Republican candidate. In 2000, he ran in the open seat in the 10th Congressional District for Congress up on the North Shore when John Porter retired, part of like 10 or 11 candidates in that race. Then in 2002, he ran for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate, which Jim Durkin won before he got slaughtered by Dick Durbin. Then in 2004, he ran against Gene Moore for Cook County Recorder of Deeds.
I used to joke around with him, call him Jim Oberweiss.
Well,
like, are you the dude, like Jim Oberweis too?
Jim Oberweis, state senator now. So I don't know, maybe John Cox, governor of California. About that time or shortly thereafter, he left for California. And then in 2006, he announced his candidacy for the Republican nomination for United States president for the 2008 campaign. He ran for president in 08.
Yes.
Not that anybody knew it. But it did generate, he tried to get into the Republican Party debates, and it generated this fascinating piece by Matt LaBash over at the Weekly Standard, who is a great writer, is very entertaining. He couldn't get in to the debates. So, but Matt LaBash was, you know, shadowing him. So instead, and this is all recounted in his piece at the Weekly Standard, the sane fringe candidate. They watched the debate from John Cox's hotel room together, and John Cox would tell Matt LaBash how he would have answered the question that the actual Republican candidates in the debate that we're watching on television were getting. And now he's a self-made guy, and I respect his success in business. And I knew him fairly well for the time he was in Illinois politics, as I said, the first half of this century. But it's just bizarre.
I know his wife. That's very bizarre. Sarah Hall is her maiden name. And I remember when she first started dating him, she said, you know, we've got this, you know, he's political. He's a Republican and he wants to hold office.
Clearly.
And now it's possible. They live in San Diego right now. And he's ready to go.
Well, here's the thing I'll say.
I heard his name driving into work today. I heard it and I said, is that, no, John Cox? Is he back?
Here's the thing I'll say about it.
Does he stand a chance?
No, he doesn't stand a chance in California. But it's interesting that he's... right now, pegged to finish ahead of Villagrosa, the former mayor of L.A., and face Gavin Newsom in the general election. He'll get killed, but it's kind of interesting. He is conservative.
Should we support him? I mean,
he's conservative, and he's a better Republican nominee than we have in this state. So, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be casting stones from the glass state in which I live.
Yeah, we should be supporting him.
It's just such a bizarre.
So bizarre. I know.
And the interesting thing is, you know, the California crack-up that's going on. There was a piece in Forbes by Michael Schellenberger. This is an attack on California from the left. Number one in poverty, California isn't our most progressive state. It's our most racist one. He suggests that California is a real-life Elysium, that very mediocre Matt Damon film, where... in the plot, the rich have fled to a luxury satellite orbiting Earth while the poor toil in dangerous conditions below. He suggests that California offers that in real time today. He points out just a number of things. The biggest difference between Elysium, the movie, and present-day California is that in the real-world version, Elysium residents believe they're progressive. How do they maintain that fiction, which is more detached from reality than Elysium the movie? By living in a fantasy world where California is leading the world in saving the environment and fighting racism. But in saving the environment, California progressives increased electricity rates, hurt manufacturing, and allowed carbon emissions to rise even while they declined in the rest of the U.S. And in vigorously protecting their right of their low-wage foreign servant class to remain in California while denying everybody, including them, affordable shelter, progressives aren't being generous, they're being selfish. Nobody wants to talk about it, but the truth is that California's liberal immigration laws have been good for the progressive residents of Elysium. They benefit directly from the downward pressure that low-skill immigrants put on wages for restaurant workers, cleaners, gardeners, and drivers. The outcome of all of these supposedly progressive policies is the most racially unequal society in the whole of the United States. They, after decades of progressives congratulating themselves on their anti-racism, low-wage workers, who are disproportionately people of color, today suffer the brunt of the state's housing, tax, and regulatory policies. And oh, by the way, you've got some Democrats in trouble in California for supporting this gas tax.
Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to process the John Cox thing.
So well, this is a criticism from the left. Progressives and powerful public unions reward themselves retirement benefits far beyond those of ordinary workers. More than 200,000 DMV workers, building permit employees, and other government workers collect retirement pensions at the age of 55 at a cost of $5.4 billion a year, 30 times more than was paid out in the year 2000. It's really interesting, the blue state crackup. And a progressive finding the progressives awash in hypocrisy. And where is Illinois? Right behind or in some cases ahead. We know what the crime rate is in Chicago versus L.A. And this story in the Tribune today, or yesterday, I believe. Chicago has more underwater homes than any other U.S. metro area. 9.1%. Is the share of homeowners across the country who are underwater on their mortgage. In Chicago, 15.5%. Worst news, 20% of Chicago's underwater homeowners owe at least twice as much as their homes are worth. So severely underwater. 253,725 homes in Chicago Metro, where the owners owe more on their mortgages than their houses are worth. A related story, the worst thing about Illinois, they've done a study. Insider.com compiled a study in conjunction with a WalletHub.com report, noting that the average household in Illinois pays $8,162 in state and local taxes annually. Which is 51st out of 50 in the nation, ahead of all 49 states and D.C., 51st out of 50 when it comes to the highest state and local tax burden in the country. The worst thing about Illinois, according to the study, what the residents say? Taxes. Now, here's some good news. Illinois is the ninth most gambling addicted state. So we'll continue to support those casinos, those sports books, mm-hmm. people trying to gamble their way out of their property tax bills. We're becoming Elysium. People are fleeing. Those that are left are locked here because their homes are underwater, or they're here temporarily until their kids are out of school or they retire. And then they're gone, the same way people have fled California for years and years on end. Not even at the same pace that's happening in Illinois right now. Real world Elysium, the product of the progressive policies. And so you can attack this from the left or the right, but the math is inexorable. That's the interesting thing.
Math tells the story. Do you know President Trump endorsed John Cox for governor? I know I'm speaking, but he said California
yes,
finally
do.
Deserves a great governor, one who understands borders, crime, and lowering taxes. John Cox is a man. He'll be the best governor you've ever had, Trump wrote on Twitter. I fully endorse John Cox for governor and look forward to working with him to make California great again.
Yeah, you won't hear him saying the same thing about Rauner, that's for sure.
No, yeah, where's that endorsement?
So, but going to California, you're talking about a criticism from the left of the public sector unions, the benefits they confer themselves, the hypocrisy of the champagne socialists. And here in Illinois, where we have the highest combined state and local tax burden in the country, we find an OpenTheBooks.com investigation review, 30,000 Illinois teachers making more than $100,000 a year, 20,000 of them are retired. I mean, sorry, excuse me, 20,000 of them are working while the rest, about almost 12,000, are retired, pulling down six-figure pensions. 30,000 Illinois teachers, they argue, you just had the Illinois pass a new minimum wage. Essentially for teachers, right? Minimum base pay of 40 grand for Illinois teachers. The new minimum wage, actually, arguably, is $100,000. 20,000 teachers currently working north of $100,000. 12,000 retire, pulling down six-figure pensions. And you want to look at some of the zip codes with the highest payouts. Lincoln Way, New Trier, Homewood Flossmoor, Hinsdale, Lincolnshire, North Shore, Park Forest. I mean, these numbers are remarkable. Monthly payout, for example, Lawrence Willey from Lincoln Way, $27,000 a month, $331,000 pension. New Trier, Henry Rangser, $321,000. Park Forest, median household. I mean, Park Forest is a poor community.
Yes, it is.
Joyce Carmine, $290,000 pension. Real World Elysiums, California and Illinois.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, you're talking about California and Illinois being real-world Elysiums. Stick in the Midwest Elysium. We talked about this last year when it happened. Former long-time 12-year state rep from Glen Ellen, Republican, Sandy Pihos, was arrested for shoplifting at Von Maur in Lombard.
What were they stealing?
She stole $571 worth of clothing from Von Maur. Store employees and police said she later came back and attempted to return those items.
Oh, to make money.
She initially pled not guilty. On Monday, she pled guilty, but did not essentially admit to what she had done. In a statement, she said, listen, this is
all right. All right, I need to hear
this. Is good.
Because she could be a kleptomaniac, or she could just be desperate for money.
Yeah, I don't think it's either. I trust that my long history of service to the community, service guided always by integrity and generosity, speaks for itself.
Oh.
If it speaks for itself, I guess you wouldn't need to reference it because it doesn't exist.
How long was she a state rep?
12 years. Oy. So that means she's got a taxpayer-funded pension.
Oh, so how much was she looking at after 12 years?
Too much. My long history of service to the community, that's how the ruling class Pauls think of themselves vis-a-vis you. She was a teachers union-backed big government Republican hack, who, by the way, of course, was supported by Jim Durkin and the establishment Republicans, the House Republican leader. And I backed Peter Breen, the now state rep, who defeated her in a primary in 2014. And now it turned out to be Jim Durkin's floor leader. It's so hilarious. Big government Republican hacks and their ruling class mentality. The Sandy Pihos mentality is what has ruled the roost in the Republican Party for the last 50 years. And it's why Illinois is going the way of California, which is to say one-party state, no functional Republican Party, just a few Republican kleptocrats in office running around, getting their table scraps from the Democrats and being satisfied with that. Sandy Pijos, I trust my long history of service to the community, service always guided by integrity and generosity, speaks for itself, says the convicted shoplifter.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. When these controversies over same-sex marriages, same-sex ceremonies arose several years back, you know, about the time of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case in 2012 in Denver, Stephen Crowder of Jesse Waters, are they the same person? They seem like it to me.
You know what? That's
Stephen Crowder did a little experiment. He went to a number of Muslim-owned bakeries in Dearborn, Michigan, and asked the same question or made the same demand that was made of Jack Phillips at Masterpiece Cake Shop in Denver. And here's how that went.
What's really important is getting the picture and the writing. So it's going to be me and Benny. Well, you have pictures there.
No, on the machine, you have in Kroger. Kitchen.
In Kroger?
Yeah.
Like the grocery store?
No.
Where you would tell me to go to more across the street. And I wanted to say Ben and Steven forever on the top. And then on the bottom, it'll say, same-sex, legal now, congratulations. But everyone keeps sending me somewhere else. They said, this is what you do here.
No, I don't want it.
Okay, well, let's even say no picture, but you can write on it, Ben loves Steven forever,
yeah.
And have our hands maybe holding.
No.
Yeah, no. So, ultimately, some of the Muslim-owned bakeries, cake shops, agreed to do the cake, and some did not.
Okay.
In 2015, a Christian activist named Bill Jack walked into three separate bakeries, one an erotic-themed shop, and asked each to design a cake in the shape of a Bible. One side saying, God hates sin, with the citation, Psalms 45:7. The other, homosexuality is a detestable sin from Leviticus. On another cake, Jack requested that the bakery inscribe a Bible verse on one side. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, Romans 5:8. On the other side, God loves sinners. In all instances, the proprietors refused to take the project, refused to bake the cakes. And as David Harsanyi writes in The Federalist, and why should any American be forced to create something that clashes against their conscience? And isn't that the point in the Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission case? Jack Phillips, on the occasion of his victory yesterday, penned an op-ed for the USA Today, writing, as a cake artist who owns my shop, I've always been willing to serve everyone who walks through my doors, but it doesn't mean that I create every cake requested of me. And he goes on to say, I'm asked to design a cake that celebrates an event or expresses a message in conflict with my faith, I'm obliged as a matter of conscience to decline, but I still offer those customers anything else in my shop and tell them that I gladly create them a cake for a different occasion, which is exactly what he did for the two gentlemen who demanded he make a cake for their same-sex wedding. I can't do that, but I can sell you brownies. I can do this. I can do that. Not good enough, because they were, you know, looking to use Jack Phillips as an example. This is politicized from the start, of course. People say, just make the cake. Just make it. What's the big deal? Just make the cake. Jack Phillips responds, those folks fail to understand that as an artist, I pour my heart into my wedding cakes and that my conscience will not allow me to celebrate something in direct conflict with my faith. And the other thing he said, writes about, in addition to losing 40% of his business and facing death threats because he dares to abide his faith tradition. This is an interesting perspective he offers. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission, the government, ordered me not only to stop doing the wedding work I love, but also to teach my remaining employees all of whom are my family members, that I was wrong to operate my shop consistent with my faith. In other words, the state told me to tell my mother that the faith she taught me has no business influencing my life. The state telling me I'm wrong to in terms of how I operate my shop and to live my life according to my faith. Remarkable. And by the way, Clarence Thomas warned that these such cases would come to pass after the Obergefell decision, that same-sex marriage was going to run headlong into religious liberty, and it has. And in this case, to be clear, the Supreme Court found the Colorado Civil Rights Commission's conduct to be bigoted and essentially beyond the pale, but they focused on the Civil Rights Commission's conduct. They didn't make a broader statement about religious liberty protections under the First Amendment, and thus the 7-2 kind of walk-away decision. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Georgetown law professor and author of Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. He is Randy Barnett. Randy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Dan and Amy, and I'm hungry. I want some cake.
Yes. Well, that depends what the message is on your cake.
Every time I hear about the cake shop cake, all these delicious cakes.
Yes, salivating.
You want a cake.
Right, of course. Well, Jack Phillips is up and running. So what about the import of this case, given its sort of narrow holding that really pertains to Jack Phillips and maybe not a lot more?
Yeah, it's a very narrow holding because this was telegraphed in oral argument. I think I mentioned to you on your program right after oral argument.
Mm-hmm.
It's a narrow holding based on the animosity or animus that was manifested by some of the commissioners who were deciding Jack Phillips' case. And this was actually something that came up a lot in oral argument. Justice Kennedy expressed his concern about that, and then immediately after that, Justices Alito and Gorsuch underscored that by other evidence in the record that showed this animosity. And that ultimately is how the case came out. So if there's another case where the government shows this kind of animosity in the future, then that's covered by this one. If the government is more careful and cautious and doesn't say the things that these commissioners said about religion, then a challenger is going to have a much harder time. And this case will be of limited help, not of no help necessarily, but of limited help.
So what does this mean for, you know, owners of small businesses? Say if you're a photographer or a florist or a makeup artist or a hairstylist and you don't want to take part in a same-sex wedding, are they protected in any way because of this ruling?
I would say they're not really protected by this ruling yet. But there hasn't been an adverse Supreme Court ruling to theirs. In other words, they're not protected by this ruling, but the court has not ruled against them either. That might happen in a future case. But I would probably advise them to just tell the customer that they are fully booked up and they're busy. If they start citing their religious objections, they may very well find themselves in Jack Phillips's position. And then at that point, they're going to be in a protracted lawsuit.
Justice Anthony Kennedy, of course, who wrote the majority opinion in Obergefell, which was literally an opinion, like an op-ed, not a legal document, continues with his op-ed writing in this case, saying, recognizing that these disputes must be resolved with tolerance, without undue respect to sincere religious beliefs, and without subjecting gay persons to indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market. That's not much of a legal standard. That requires a lot of Solomonic decision-making on a case-by-case basis, doesn't it?
Yeah, but that itself doesn't make it objectionable if, in fact, the Constitution is limited to protecting persons from intentional discrimination. You have to examine the motives for a particular ruling. We have that in our anti-discrimination laws generally. Employers are only held guilty of discrimination if they intended, let's say they adopt a test that they and do so intended to restrict people on the basis of race, even if they don't say so. The courts will inquire into intent. And that's essentially what Justice Kennedy is doing here. He did a similar thing in the Hialeah case, in which there was a law passed that banned the sacrifice of animals. Why? Because one particular religion was doing it, and he saw that there was evidence in the record that showed that this law was aimed at them. It had animus towards that religion. He said that's barred by the First Amendment.
The problem, it seems to me, though, and Clarence Thomas touched on this in his dissent in Obergefell, is, I'll just borrow from Justice Thomas's words, decision rejects the idea captured in the Declaration of Independence that human dignity is innate and suggests instead that it comes from the government. This distortion of our Constitution not only ignores the text, it inverts the relationship between the individual and the state in our republic. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with that statement that Justice Thomas made about dignity isn't given by government. It's something one has, and government can't take it away. It doesn't really help us in this case very much. This case was about whether a law of general application, which is an anti-discrimination law, would apply to Jack Phillips, or whether the First Amendment, free exercise of religion, or freedom of speech provisions would somehow exempt him. It did protect him up to a point. It protected him from explicit animosity towards religion. That's not nothing. And there are possibly other cases like the Arlene Flower case, which is going to also have evidence of such biases. But if government is cautious and doesn't express these opinions, a challenger is going to have a much harder row to hoe. And this case isn't going to help them. They're going to have to appeal their own case to a court that might have a different makeup by the time a case like that got to the court.
Well, right. Yeah. And so the question is, what kind of case? I guess the fact pattern of a case where the Supreme Court could establish a precedent in these matters that has a broader application. I mean, so if the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had been polite rather than kind of openly and bigotedly hostile to Jack Phillips, the case could have turned out differently. And that would have had perhaps more sweeping implications in terms of restricting religious liberty.
Yes, it could have turned out differently, but because that case wasn't before the court, we can't be 100% sure that it would turn out differently. Justice Gorsuch argued why it shouldn't turn out differently, in part because regardless of what their statements were, the commission and the Court of Appeals treated other examples of bakers refusing to deliver cakes they thought were offensive differently than this cake. And so that differential treatment was also problematic, according to Justice Gorsuch. So the point is we just don't have an opinion on the ultimate issue. But I think supporters of free exercise of religion are going to be satisfied or happy to take this half a loaf or half a cake, we should say, because half a cake is better than no cake
exactly.
at all, which is what would have happened if it had come out the other way.
So it was a 7-2 decision.
We should also... Yeah, you asked that question because that's where I was going next.
Yes, and have ice cream with your cake. 7-2 decision. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor are the only two that dissented. Is this some ray of hope when these cases come up before the Supreme Court in the future?
It suggests that Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer, they joined Justice Kennedy's opinion, making it a 7-2 opinion, agreed that local governments cannot express animosity towards religion. And if they rule based on that animosity, that's unconstitutional under the First Amendment, even though the law they were enforcing was general. So that's a good thing that we have a 7-2 decision like that. It takes away some of the political valence against this decision, but it doesn't get us all the way. And Justice Kagan, in her concurring opinion, explains that as long as there's no expressed animosity, then the case would have come out differently as far as she's concerned.
An interesting response from one representative of the other viewpoint is this Jennifer Finney Boylan op-ed in the New York Times. She's apparently an academic at Barnard College and also a trans woman. She suggests something that the president and chief executive of GLAAD, which is a gay rights group, has proposed, which is the Dignity Amendment. The Dignity Amendment to the Constitution, equality of rights under the law shall not be abridged by the United States by any state or by any state on account of sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity, quote unquote, the Dignity Amendment. Do we need a dignity? I mean, need, I guess, is perhaps the wrong way to say it, but is there anything in the proposed Dignity Amendment that isn't covered by the 14th Amendment?
I really haven't thought of, I haven't read the amendment. I really don't know what it says, and I haven't given it any thought. So I tend to decline to answer questions, counsel, until I have had a chance to reflect
All right.
on it
All right.
a little
All right.
longer.
So be
All
right. that way.
But I mean, you know, it's more of a general statement of principle, though, that the Fifth and 14th Amendments guarantee equal protection of the law for all Americans, regardless of their race, gender, orientation, and the like, right?
Look, I think the Due Process Clause, which really ought to be called the Due Process of Law Clause, in both the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, protects citizens from arbitrary rule.
Mm-hmm.
That is, rule that's based on no reason at all, or a reason that's bad reason, a reason that's not within Congress's power or the state's power to legislate. So, yeah, I think that the 14th Amendment already protects individuals, same-sex individuals and other individuals, against arbitrary or irrational discrimination. That's my reading of the 14th Amendment, and we don't need another amendment to say that any better.
He is Randy Barnett, Georgetown law professor, by way of Chicago, I'll yes. add, and author of the book Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Professor Barnett, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
I always usually add that I grew up in Calumet City, right across the border from Indiana, and so I have to throw that in there again this time.
All right, Cal City, Sin City.
I know. Well, I was going to just say Cal City, not Sin
City. All right. Now that Randy's left, it's no longer Sin City. Thanks, Randy. Appreciate it.
Bye.
You've joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Some breaking news. Miss America is what, Dan? They've scrapped
the show's Miss America organization correspondent. I'm reporting that they have scrapped the swimsuit and evening gown competitions in the wake of the Me Too movement.
Why don't they just answer the questions in a swimsuit or do their talent in an evening gown? This is going to be boring.
Well, they're going to judge women the way that I judge them, based on their brains.
Oh, my gosh.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And again, I don't know how to tell you this, but
we should warn people that they might want to sit down before you deliver this news.
It's true.
But I guess we already kind of delivered it. But
branding the competition Miss America 2.0, Gretchen Carlson, formerly of Fox News.
Former Miss America.
Chairman of the Board of Trustees for the, or chairperson or woman or whatever, chair, inanimate object, whatever you want to call it. She's the chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Miss America organization. We are no longer a pageant. We are a competition. And a competition that will not include swimsuits. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Come on,
64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Who would like to join me in applauding the Miss America organization for its enlightened decision to launch a 2.0 version in the Me Too era?
Okay, part of the beauty of a beauty pageant is knowing what's under the hood. So you got to see what's there.
You mean on the inside?
No, I mean the like bate.
The heart and the mind, right?
No, I mean there. I mean, it's always, I know people don't like the objectification of women, but you know what? These women are gorgeous and they should show it off while they have it. Because ladies, later on, things are going to start sagging.
You know,
and things are going to start shifting places that you don't particularly like. So if you're a beauty, why not show your natural self? Hey, I say go full frontal.
Full frontal. Wow. That would
have
been a real
all.
Battle royale between you and Gretchen Carlson if you were on the board of the Miss America organization.
But honestly, is anybody upset? Or you can't talk about it, though, because you're a man and then you look like you're...
No, I mean,
if you didn't watch it before, now really, who's going to watch it? Are they trying to drive ratings into the ground?
Well, I know we are all very opposed to the objectification of women, particularly women.
Yeah.
They don't comment on the physical appearance of women. They don't even notice other women's physical appearance.
Yes, they do. Half the people watch TV because they want to see what other women are wearing or what their hair is or how they have their makeup.
We just got over the royal wedding where nobody was paying attention to the physical appearance of Meghan Markle.
Oh, please. Everybody was paying attention to her. I mean, look at this. Can you imagine? Look at these beautiful women. Now we can't see them anywhere. So are they going to wear muumuus? Oh, maybe they'll answer the question during the interview portion of the contest wearing muumuus.
Don't the burkas maybe? Something a little bit more than that.
Shador, just, you know, cover it all up.
Well,
the Muslims must be rejoicing. Oh, great.
The Miss America contestants tend to be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, they work hard for these awesome, beautiful bodies that we can't see anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not changing teams or anything, but I can respect a good-looking woman.
Me
and
too.
And this is...
for her mind.
Speaking of minds, I mean, what about... I have the best idea. During the question and answer portion, they can wear a swimsuit during that time. So if they mess up, people just look at their beautiful body and not get underneath their heads.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and
sure.
I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much.
Build up
South
our future.
Carolina.
Oh, and for
Mario
our children.
Lopez, like, they're there now. Thank you.
Mario Lopez thought it was a brilliant answer. He did a ding bat,
too. He looked scared.
What is going to replace the swimsuit competition, you asked?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. What is going to replace the swimsuit competition?
Passion.
What?
Passion.
Passion?
In a live session with the judges, the contestants from all 50 states and the District of Columbia will be asked to demonstrate their passion, intelligence, and an overall understanding of the job of Miss America. Well, let me tell you something. If anybody can demonstrate an overall understanding of the job of Miss America, then crown that woman, because I don't know what
it is.
You're
just a mascot. You go and speak to young women to encourage them to succeed.
You're an inspiration, like when you used to travel around Iowa as one of the Kappa Phi Gamma girls.
I was a Kappa Gamma. I was in the women of...
Phi Slamma Gamma? What was it?
Kappa Kappa Gamma.
You and Clyde Drexler.
As Meghan Markle is as well. And no, we didn't tour the state, but we did have some appearances, you know, at the mall, the Capitol Mall.
Now, I know because you showed this pornography in studio here that in the calendar, the Iowa girls calendar.
It's the women of Iowa.
Yeah, right.
We're not girls, we're women.
Right, of course.
Yeah, I wore a bikini. I donned
a
bikini.
Swimsuit.
Yeah, it was a bikini. And it was awesome.
And to be fair,
back then.
As I don't want to, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot and not admit to my own doing in this space. For the D&D Club of Bennett Academy, the calendar that we did.
Oh, Dungeons and Dragons.
Dungeons and Dragons Club of Bennett Academy. I wore a swimsuit as well.
You did?
Yeah.
Was it a mankini? Or did you just wear the swim trunks?
It was tight in the right places. Frank in St. Charles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I agree with the decision. So we won't have to look at anorexic, spray-tanned, practically naked women.
Oh, I know. It's horrible.
Amy, you've talked about this before. What do you think of these people on the news where the man is all bundled up in a suit and tie, and then you have
the women look like they're going to cocktail parties. I know.
Sleeveless, half naked, skin bare. I don't want to see your bare arms. Put some clothes on.
Well, some arms, I know. You know what, Frank, I hear you. I'll never forget. I wore a sleeveless dress once, and I was ridiculed by Phyllis Schwartz. She called me, what are you doing? I said, it's 104 today. It was a lovely dress. My husband fell out of bed. What are you doing? And now everybody does it. Everybody. But even in the wintertime, it looks weird, and some arms should be covered. Because
that's
as you
standard equipment.
Yep.
Okay.
Remember?
Thanks for the call, Frank. You're not going to be my wingman.
Remember Tharms? If your arms start looking like Tharms, you might want to cover that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A quote from Dan Proft.
All we have to do is, you know, change the change human nature, and then this will all make sense. Paul in Waukesha.
Yeah, I got a decent idea, I think, and it'll help with the athleticism. I'm thinking maybe log rolling. How about that one?
Log rolling instead of
get,
the swimsuit.
You get competition. You got two of them on there, and if they both happen to fall in the water, oh, my gosh.
All right. Okay. I see what you did there. Thanks for the call, Paul.
All right, here we go. So Carlson said that the new Miss America competition is more inclusive to women of all shapes and sizes. That's why they're getting rid of the swimsuit. And on their Twitter account, they had a short video of a white bikini going up in a puff of smoke with the hashtag bye-bye bikini.
So somebody like a
Rosie. So now everything's no. There's going to be no more Me Too movements now because of this.
Somebody like a Rosie O'Donnell could be Miss America then.
Yeah, I guess so. This is what we want. This is what we want to celebrate as Miss America.
Yeah,
plus size models are not bad looking.
I don't know what Frank was talking about. I'm looking at a picture from a recent Miss America. Anorexic and stuff. They look pretty healthy to me.
Remember, the camera adds 10 pounds.
You don't have to tell me. Candace and DuPage.
I'm with Amy. Several points. Cindy Crawford was once asked, why do you have such a beautiful nanny? And she said, because I have to look at her too. I'm with Cindy Crawford. I want to see beautiful women, not some lard, but up there. Oh, wow. I'm not going to watch it. My two favorite parts were always the gown
and the bikini.
And here's why I like those two parts, because I never thought the questions were fair, because they should all be put in a booth and not be able to hear each other's answers, and should all be asked the same question, so it's apples to apples.
Thanks for the call, Candace. You know what I'd like to do is actually put Silicon Valley tech CEOs next to Miss America contestants, give them the same questions, put them in the ISO booth, and see how similar their answers are.
Okay.
Because it's always going to include the future and our children and making the world a better place.
Maybe throw in some Africa.
Honestly.
Just for, you know, bonus points.
So I'm not just lampooning the Miss America contestants. I'm also lampooning, Larry and Sergey at Google. James in Westmont.
Good morning, you two. Yeah, I think it should just be like a big IQ contest. What do you think? That all the ladies should just, you know, sit at a desk and they have to answer multiple choice questions, you know, have the camera pan over to watch them, you know, struggle with the answers.
Riveting.
Like, you know, what to do about, you know, world peace. That's what it sounds like it's going to. Is that maybe it's just me? I don't know.
Thanks for the call, James. What about doing like a firing line debate between the contestants? You split the 20 finalists up 10 and 10, and you do a fire line debate on denuclearization of North Korea. Who'd tune in for that?
I would, if only if they're wearing a swimsuit.
Exactly.
During the segment.
Joe in Lake Bluff.
Yeah, I would put them in there and do like a Sudoku contest. Maybe in Lululemon outfits and, you know, watch them sweat while they're trying to figure out the Sudoku.
All right. Thanks, Joe. It's good ideas. A lot of good ideas.
Now for our activewear segment, Miss Pennsylvania. Isn't she great in her Lululemon crop pants and top?
Isn't that patronizing?
The dry fit.
You're doing a pretty good impersonation of how they introduce the contestants. Isn't that a bit patronizing?
Yeah, a little bit. And let's welcome to the stage Miss Illinois. She's currently from Decatur, Illinois, studying in journalism. She hopes one day to be an anchor on the Today Show. Do you want me to go on?
I think it should just be dudes. Steve in Downers Grove.
Yeah, that was me. Well, I'm happy with all the changes. At least we don't have any gay men in there yet. They'll probably be next year. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Steve.
Oh, boy. What if we... Oh, no. Why do you have to bring that up? Because that's going to happen. We're going to have transgender women.
Yeah, it'll be like a, you know, once a year Sunday night thing at the Baton Club. That'll be the Miss America pageant. What's wrong with that? Cher will win every year. Some dude from Schaumburg does a Cher impersonator for Miss America. Andy in Hanover Park.
Yeah, I was going to suggest mud wrestling, but I guess I'm kind of going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
But that Frank guy really disturbed me. I don't know what he wants to look at.
Frank,
but anyway,
yeah,
I think we need to change the conversation and focus on how much work those girls do to get their bodies like that.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time in the gym or in the yoga studio or, you know, it's over. I can't believe this is this bad. What about Miss USA? They're still going to do it, right?
I don't know.
Uh-oh, I better check.
Yeah, all of the sponsoring organizations, the title-granting organizations. Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning. Yeah, eliminate talking altogether. That will make it much better.
No talking.
I think that for the talent competition, they should simplify it and just have like basic identification of shapes, like stars and circles. Maybe they could put them in those balls, you know, where there's a bunch of plastic pieces out front.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, since all the swimsuits going away, we're going to have the scooter crowd up there pretty soon. And then maybe for talent, we could watch them gum a steak and some corn on the cob.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. It's not bad. The rascal competition.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like an obstacle course or something. A bunch of heavy women and or men in rascals, like on a double dare course. Susan in West Chicago.
What's going on in America?
Hi.
Hi.
I feel that the Miss America contest has never been anything but a celebration of conceit.
Why?
What?
So why?
Why?
Why is it a celebration of conceit?
Because those girls think they're better than everybody else, and there's more beautiful women walking around on the street than on there.
Well, but I mean,
they choose to show off. They choose to showcase their beauty, and they want to be a princess. They want to be a queen.
It's a competition. I mean, what competition isn't it part of display of conceit?
Well, whatever.
All right.
I guess you have a point too.
All right.
Just the way I would never want my daughter to be doing that. I'll tell you that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's a
Thanks for the
world.
Call, Susan. What about your daughters and sons sexting? Does that concern you at all? Since people are so exercised about the Miss America pageant? Have you seen some of the recent studies about sexting?
No.
About how negatively impactful it is on the mental health of teenagers?
Great.
Well, I mean, it's just one of those things. It's interesting. People get worked up about Miss America pageant.
Because we're just trying to process this. This is breaking news.
Well, I'm saying just in terms of like this sort of thing, you've sort of have preformed opinions about it. And then what's going on in my backyard, I have no idea. Bob in Waukegan.
Yeah, I think that commercial they have with the bikini, the white bikini going up in smoke, I think that they're going to replace that with no ratings. High school kids, you know, they go out and sneak Playboys because they want to read the articles. If they take the swimsuit section out of the pageant, they're going to lose every male watcher in the entire country except those who are browbeat by their wives.
It's going to be like the NFL. Yeah, thanks for the call, Bob. Lee and Hammond.
Yeah, how do you guys feel about like a Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome theme, like the Cage of Death, two goes in and one comes out?
I like that. Yeah, like
that?
Like a tournament. Yeah, I like that. Thanks for the call, Lee. Yeah, now we're getting somewhere. Girls properly attired fighting to the death.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
More texts on Miss America eliminating the swimsuit competition. Having a beauty pageant that has zero to do with beauty is so 2018. Should just change it to Miss Social Justice.
Oh, that's good.
That's a good point. How about these? How about objectifying young brainiacs in the spelling bee? They were given high IQs, and that's their gift. Some women are given the gift of beauty. People like to see and appreciate beauty. Generally, it's unattractive people who want it banned. Professional athletes are being objectified. We want to watch them in awe of their physical talent. Why can't physical beauty be celebrated, too? I celebrate my physical beauty every day.
And you're beautiful on the inside.
Thank you so much.
I can't even say that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Bill Clinton yesterday on the Today Show got a little bitchy with one of the Today Show hosts.
think he just got a little hot under the collar. He was blindsided by this question.
Never had the question before about Monica Lewinsky.
Well, it's been,
where did this come from?
20 years.
He should be totally practiced at lying about it by this stage. I mean, he's done it for 20 years, is your point. So I don't know why he was caught off kilter so much. But anyway, Clinton's out promoting a novel he co-wrote with James Patterson, The President is Missing, and on the Today Show with him. And then he gets asked about his past exploits in the context of the Me Too movement. By the way, he just had to answer these questions for an entire presidential campaign 2 years ago.
I don't like all this. I couldn't be elected anything now because I just don't like embarrassing people. My mother would have.
So a lot of the facts have been conveniently omitted to make the story work. But I think partly because they're frustrated that they got all these serious allegations against the current occupant of the Oval Office and his voters don't seem to care. I think I did the right thing. I defended the Constitution.
You think this president's been given a pass with regards to the women who have come forward and accused him of sexual misconduct?
Well, I think that, no. No, I felt terrible then. And I came to grips with it.
Did you ever apologize to him?
No, yes, and nobody believes that I got out of that for free. I left the White House $16 million in debt.
Couldn't pay his mortgage.
But you typically have ignored gaping facts in describing this, and I bet you don't even know them. This was litigated 20 years ago. Two-thirds of the American people sided with me. They were not insensitive to that. I had a sexual harassment policy when I was governor in the 80s. I had two women chiefs of staff when I was governor. Women were overrepresented in the attorney general's office in the 70s. For their percentage in the bar. I've had nothing but women leaders in my office since I left. You are giving one side and omitting facts.
Mr. President, I'm not trying to present a side.
You asked me if I agreed. The answer is no, I don't.
And I asked if you'd ever apologized, and you said you had.
I have.
You've apologized to
her. I apologize to everybody in the world.
But then he went on to say, well, what kind of apology? Was it a face-to-face?
But you didn't apologize to her.
I have not talked to her.
Do you feel like you owe her an apology?
No, I do. I do not. I have never talked to her. But I did say publicly on more than one occasion that I was sorry. That's very different. The apology was public.
And you don't think a private apology is owed?
I think this thing has been, it's 20 years ago. Come on. Let's talk about JFK. Let's talk about...
No, let's not. We're talking about Bill Clinton. Yeah. And we're still talking about him yesterday after his Today Show appearance where he got a little agitated. He made another stop with James Patterson in New York to promote the book, and he addressed the interview.
The truth is, the hubbub was I got hot under the collar because of the way the questions were asked. And I think what was lost are the two points that I made that are important to me. The suggestion was that I'd never apologized for what caused all the trouble for me 20 years ago. So first point is, I did. I meant it then and I meant it now. I apologize to my family, to Monica Lewinsky and her family, and to the American people. Before a panel of ministers in the White House.
I assembled a panel of ministers and I apologized quietly to them. Also, it doesn't address the issue, and Megyn Kelly and others have brought this up to their credit, of the rape allegations that have been lodged against Bill Clinton by Juanita Broderick. It doesn't address, and it wasn't asked, the settlement that the president consummated with Paula Jones. So, there are some questions to ask if you want to wrap yourself in the Me Too movement and also decide to sit in judgment of President Trump as well. But it's interesting, Clinton's reemergence now that he's hawking a book, Something else is relevant here, because he's obviously comparing his impeachment proceeding, mm-hmm. a tribulation, with what President Trump may be facing or should be facing in his estimation. And so what's dominated the last couple of days is, can the president pardon himself? Not that he needs to, because there's no allegation he's done anything wrong, at least no evidence to support an allegation that he's done anything wrong. But can the president pardon himself? And President Trump has said he can. Rudy Giuliani said he can. And
he can, right? But he just shouldn't talk about it?
Well, he arguably can. The idea is that I can do that, but it's an irrelevant question because there's no need for me to do anything because I've done nothing wrong, so there will be nothing for me to pardon. That, I think, is sort of better messaging than what we've been getting from Rudy Giuliani for the last couple of days. But, you know, it's funny because the D.C. press corps is in a twist over this idea the president could pardon himself in this conversation that they want to foment. A Slate article from 1998, Slate, you know, left-wing mag, can President Clinton pardon himself?
Oh.
The simplest interpretation of Article 2, pardon power, president. The simplest interpretation is the president can pardon any federal criminal offense, including his own, but cannot pardon an impeachment. In other words, Clinton is free to immunize himself from criminal prosecution, but has no power over Congress. Yeah, right. Right. Pardon except in cases of impeachment. Andy McCarthy has written about this as well, former federal prosecutor. He says, yes, the president can pardon himself. There's no question about this. He notes that President Ford pardoned Nixon, even though he had not been indicted. President Lincoln mass pardoned Confederate soldiers and sympathizer. President Carter mass pardoned Vietnam draft evaders. Thus, the fact that Special Counsel Mueller has not, may never file criminal charges would not prevent President Trump from issuing pardons, including for himself. Yes, a pardon is judicially unreviewable act of executive discretion. McCarthy writes, I think of it as an iteration of prosecutorial discretion, which is the judicially unreviewable executive decision whether to charge someone with a crime. It is a sweeping presidential authority. The only exceptions of it are obvious from the Constitution's Pardon Clause, Article 2, Section 2, which limits pardons to offenses against the United States. That is, the president may only pardon offenses that have already occurred. He cannot grant a prospective get-out-of-jail-free card for future crimes. And then, of course, the president may not pardon state offenses that are outside his jurisdiction over federal law enforcement. So that's the argument, the sum total of it. But with the reintroduction of Bill Clinton yet again, they never go away. And not just on the matter of respective treatment of women, but also on the underlying issue of the prospect of impeachment, the move to impeachment, and then this discussion over the last 2 days about the president's pardon power. Let's set it clear. So while the president's legal team, Rudy Giuliani specifically, may be guilty of poor communication on the topic, and I think he is, no one is saying that the president is above the law, and Sarah Sanders made that explicit yesterday.
Sarah, let me ask you if I can. Does the president believe that he is above the law?
Certainly not. The president hasn't done anything wrong.
The question isn't if he's done anything wrong. I guess the question is, does the president believe the framers envisioned a system where the president couldn't pardon himself, where the president could be above the law?
Certainly the Constitution very clearly lays out the law. And once again, the president hasn't done anything wrong, and we feel very comfortable in that front.
I know, but you just a moment ago said it's not that clear. So I guess simply put, does the president believe he is above the law?
Certainly no one is above the law. Vivian, go ahead.
If I can't follow, just because I have
sorry, now I'm going to keep going right here.
Yeah, now we're done. And so you've got three bites at the apple. That's plenty. So the president believing he's above the law and the president believing he has the power to pardon himself are not synonymous. The Constitution pretty clearly provides the president with such authority. It's broad authority. That doesn't mean that we should believe the president is above the law. And it doesn't necessarily insulate the president from prosecution either for crimes committed. Just to make those distinctions that are lost in the D.C. press corps. Margo and Burr Ridge, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. Getting back to Bill Clinton, this is not a legal question. What the reason the whole thing with Monica Lewinsky points up to what an evil man he is because she gave him her heart. All these other women,
you had
they
hello.
The Jennifer Flowers, they were into sports sex. The current Energizer Bunny, same thing. Paula Jones, Juanita Broderick, and Kathleen Willey. You know, they've all been recognized, and they all spoke up, and you know, she's different because he had nothing to offer her. She offered her heart, and he had nothing to offer. She was just another sports sex thing for him, he took her future. She has no respect the world over. She's infamous for what she did with him. He has wealth. She has none. He has a child. She'll have none. He has grandchildren. None for her. He destroyed her entire life, and for just for a few afternoons of fun or a few moments of fun. And he is a truly evil man, and that escapade of his with Monica Lewinsky points that out.
All right. Thanks for the call, Margo.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, how about this? The Parkland High School students that want to take your guns are coming to Chicago. June 16th.
Are they going to be on stage with Stormy Daniels? Because she'll be here that week.
I'm surprised they're not going to be at that cult that you call a church. But no, they're coming to Naperville June 16th at the DuPage Unitarian, of course, Universalist Church. Yeah. Reflects the church commitment to reducing gun violence. You know, the Unitarians in DuPage there. 6 p.m. June 16th, the Parkland kids.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.